An hour later, he climbed behind the wheel of a well-used Toyota Land Cruiser and twisted the key in the ignition. Jerome stood with both hands resting on the open passenger side window.
Good luck, my friend.
How do I get the Land Cruiser back to you?
No problem, man. Mr. Walt is a good friend. He will make sure it gets back to me. I will let him know that you have arrived. Feed his dog when you get there. It will save me a trip. The dog's name is Bureau.
Aaron Holland nodded as if any of this made sense to him. He had needed luck to get to this point and would surely need more in the weeks to come. This first spell, he hoped, would continue long enough to get him through the interior of Jamaica and to the west end of the island, into the parish of Negril, and to the house that belonged to a man named Walt Jenkins. With no cell phone and the Land Cruiser's gas gauge pegged at just under half a tank, he figured he'd need all the luck he could find. Finally, he put the Toyota into gear and pulled away. He was pulling away from more than just a rum distillery in Jamaica, and from more than just a stranger who had willingly surrendered his vehicle to him. Christopher Montgomery was pulling away from his old life, from the stress of spending years in hiding. He was pulling away from the role he unknowingly played as a portfolio manager at his father's hedge fund. But now, perhaps, he could be free of all that. As free as a man on the run could ever be. Westmoreland, Jamaica, Thursday, October 21st, 2021. The boat's journey had started in Sister Bay, Wisconsin, where it headed north out of Green Bay before wrapping around Washington Island and trekking down the entire length of Lake Michigan. It passed through the locks in Chicago, where the boat rose and fell with other vessels and ships. The sails were never raised. Instead, the boat's motor burned through gasoline and oil. It was the fastest way. The purpose of this journey was transport, not adventure. Once through the Chicago locks, the crew pointed the moorings 35.2 south and chugged down the Illinois River. From there, they connected to the Mississippi and eventually found the Ten Tom Waterway, which took them to Mobile, Alabama. During one leg of the voyage, the masts had to come down to clear low-hanging bridges. But finally, after 14 days of grunt travel, the Beneteau glided into the Gulf of Mexico. From there, it motored to the southern tip of Florida, where, finally, the crew set the sails. By then, the boat needed to spread its wings. America disappeared behind them. The island of Jamaica did not become visible for 3 more days. Negril, Jamaica, Friday, October 22nd, 2021. Avery felt the thick humidity of the Caribbean as soon as she stepped onto the tarmac. Her flight was 6 hours, direct from Los Angeles into Montego Bay. She made it through customs and wheeled her suitcase outside. The airport was busy with tourists waiting in long lines to pour onto buses and vans that would deliver them to the island's beaches, where they would drink rum and try hard to bronze their pale skin. Avery made her way through the crowd and saw Walt standing in the crook of the open driver's side door and waving to her over the roof of the Land Cruiser. It was the same vehicle, Avery knew, that her brother drove 3 months earlier when he first arrived in Jamaica. Avery hustled over and climbed into the passenger seat while Walt threw her bag in the trunk.
How was your flight?
Long.
He pulled out of the terminal.
How is he?
Settled and enjoying island life. I may or may not have turned him on to single-batch Jamaican rum.
Avery smiled.
He's really anxious to see you.
Did the boat get here?
Yesterday, right on schedule. Christopher wanted to inspect it, but I told him we had to wait for you.
How did it look?
The boat? Great, but I don't know anything about boats.
It's a beautiful boat.
I'll take your word for it.
Then, it was quiet for a long time, as Walt navigated out of the airport and onto the main highway that would take them to Negril. He finally spoke after 30 minutes.
I missed you.
I still think you're an asshole.
No argument from me on that front. Just know that I'm working really hard on changing that.
A minute of silence passed before Avery spoke.
I missed you too.
I'll take that. I'll take that any day of the week.
Walt reached over and took her hand. She didn't resist. Most of the drive to Negril was on the main road, which was populated with tour buses, vans, and motorcycles that slithered in and out of traffic. The ocean was to Avery's right. The water was crystal clear nearer to shore, offering a glimpse of coral deep beneath its surface. Farther from land, the water turned a rich cobalt. Palm trees were everywhere. In the city of Negril, they exited the main road and headed toward the interior of the island, away from the tour buses and far from the ocean and beaches. The roads on this leg of the journey were narrow and shaded by heavy foliage. The farther into the rainforest Walt drove, the more excited she became. She didn't speak for the last 30 minutes of the trip. All Avery wanted was to get there and see him.
5 more minutes.
Those minutes felt like hours until Walt finally slowed the car, made a right turn, and pulled up the driveway of a well-kept blue house tucked into a nook of mangroves and palm trees. The closest neighbor was 2 acres away and very much out of sight. This had been the perfect place for Christopher to stay while Avery finished the last of her plans. Walt had promised that it would be.
Thank you.
Walt nodded and then pointed at the house.
Get in there.
Avery opened the door and stepped onto the pebbled driveway. A dog ran down the driveway to greet her. The front door of the house opened and Christopher walked onto the front patio. Avery ran for him. Christopher Montgomery was 3 years older than his little sister. Age, however, provided little leverage and no advantage. Avery was better than him at most things. She had been a better student and was a better sailor. She was more charismatic and outgoing. She could likely, if things ever got out of control between them, overpower him in a wrestling match. But there was one thing Christopher beat her at. Math. He was a savant when it came to numbers. Math and all its derivatives came easily to him. In fact, he had never felt the need to learn the subject. The knowledge was somehow already in his brain. He was born with it. All he had to do was organize the information and apply it to any version of math. In college, he majored in mathematics. After college, he earned a master's degree in applied and computational mathematics. If he had had a normal father, perhaps Christopher Montgomery would have become a professor or an actuary for the insurance industry. Instead, he took his mathematical brain to Wall Street and joined Montgomery Investment Services as an analyst. Christopher applied himself to studying the market and determining the probabilities and statistical analysis of making money by trading stocks and commodities. Surprising to no one, he was very good at it. So good, in fact, that he rose to the top of the food chain at his father's firm and was soon offering his advice, not just to his father, but to every partner about which industries to place the hedge fund's assets into. Christopher became so lost in the statistical analysis of the firm's funds that he couldn't see the forest for the trees. Until one night when he was alone and working late. His mind functioned best when the offices of Montgomery Investment Services were empty. That was when he first began to unravel the fraud that was taking place. It took him weeks of working through the night to dissect the firm's financial misdeeds. The offices of Montgomery Investment Services occupied the entire 40th floor of the Prudential Building in Lower Manhattan. And once Christopher smelled corruption, he didn't care how many chances he took. Late at night, after the cleaning crew was gone, he entered his father's office and searched through his computer. He did the same to each of the partners. What took the feds 2 years to uncover, Christopher had learned in 2 weeks. Montgomery Investment Services was dirty as sin, and Christopher's name and brain power was behind nearly every deal that had been made. As quickly as he pieced together the fraud, Christopher also figured out that he would be considered as guilty as anyone else at the firm. His digital fingerprints were on nearly every trade. He would be implicated in the Ponzi scheme as much as his father or any of the partners. Implicated, prosecuted, indicted, and imprisoned. And the feds were coming, he knew. An old friend with whom he had studied applied mathematics worked for the IRS and had confirmed Christopher's suspicions. Christopher asked for a favor, and his friend obliged. While Christopher spent 2 weeks unraveling the financial crimes at Montgomery Investment Services, his friend made a few calls and did some snooping of his own. The friend didn't know much, he told Christopher, but he had learned that there was an active investigation going on that involved the FBI's math geeks, the nickname used for the forensic accountants who worked for the government. His friend had even managed to get the name of the operation, House of Cards. There were many choices Christopher Montgomery could have made. He could have gone to the feds and cut a deal. He could provide all the access they needed. He could have been a siphon to it all. He could have confronted his father and demanded that things change, but he knew things were too far gone. He could have attempted to erase his fingerprints from the trades and plead ignorance, but each of those choices had flaws. Attached to all of them was the likelihood that he would go to prison. So, instead, he had told Claire about their father's hedge fund and the fraud and the billions in assets that were nothing but a mirage. He had told her how he was neck deep in it all, even though until recently he knew nothing about any of it. Then, he had asked for her help. There was no perfect way to fake your own death, but he had been adamant that he needed to do it before the feds busted down the doors, because to fake your death after an indictment was too suspicious. To fake your death a year before anyone at Montgomery Investment Services came under federal indictment was possible, if they did it the right way. Sacrificing her Oyster 625 took some convincing, but after Christopher explained that the boat, and everything else in their lives, had come from dirty money, Claire had agreed. Knowing that the marina had surveillance cameras, he and Claire had climbed aboard the Clairvoyance, prepared the boat for a sail, and pushed off. It was only after they were a mile offshore that Christopher boarded the dinghy and made it back to land, a different marina where surveillance was less severe. Then, he had prayed that Claire would survive. The storm was as brutal as forecasted, and Christopher did his best to keep track of the news as he drove. It was 16 hours from Manhattan to Sister Bay, Wisconsin, and Christopher stopped only for gas. When he did, he kept his sunglasses on his face and his ball cap pulled low over his eyes. By the time he reached Connie Clarkson's sailing camp, it was 6 in the morning and the sun was rising. When he opened the door to Cabin 12, he was met with the smell of fresh-brewed coffee and pancakes and said a silent prayer of thanks that he had Connie in his life. He clicked on the news and ate like a wild animal. His biggest regret, even greater than asking Claire to sacrifice the Oyster 625 and risk her life for him, was that the money Connie Clarkson had given his father for safekeeping was gone. Like many of his father's victims, Connie Clarkson was blind to the fraud until she learned the cold, hard truth that any money given to Montgomery Investment Services had disappeared like smoke in the wind. It was noon before Christopher found the story on CNN's webpage. A sailboat had sunk off the coast of Manhattan during a violent storm. One passenger, a woman, had been rescued by the Coast Guard. A search and rescue operation had been launched for a second passenger. Up to that point, things had worked. He had planned to hide at Connie's for a couple of weeks. He never imagined it would take 3 years to leave Cabin 12 and the sailing camp. Westmoreland, Jamaica, Friday, October 29th, 2021. The port of Savannah-Lamar was a 30-minute drive from Negril. Avery sat in the front seat as Walt drove the Land Cruiser toward the ocean. A week earlier, Walt had accepted receipt of the sailboat at the small marina there. The slip had been rented for a month, paid in full and in advance. It only took 3 days to spin through the checklist of repairs the boat needed after making the long journey from Sister Bay. Over the last 3 days, they stocked the vessel with non-perishable food, water, and everything else someone might need to spend weeks on the water. Christopher's goal was to disappear for a year to make sure no one was looking for him. By then, they would be certain that his escape had indeed been flawless. The only worry was that their father, facing the rest of his life in jail, might mention to the feds that he believed his son was still alive. Neither Christopher nor Avery believed that their father knew the truth. Still, it was safest for Christopher to take to the sea while their father was prosecuted. There was no telling the extremes he might go to lessen his sentence. That his own daughter had betrayed him and turned him over to the feds was surely a bitter pill Garth Montgomery would not swallow easily. But it had been part of the long game Avery concocted the moment her father's postcard arrived in the mail. The final details had come together with Walt's help. The best way, Walt had told her, to make sure the eyes of the FBI were off the airports, borders, and ports was to divert the agency's attention. And the apprehension of one of their highest targets was the best way to do it. In a year, when the coast was clear, the plan was for Christopher to return to Jamaica and start his new life. His job at Hampton Estates Distillery would be waiting for him, and there were worse ways to spend time as a free man. Holed up in a cabin in Sister Bay, Wisconsin, working at Connie Clarkson's sailing camp had been a temporary arrangement that had run far past its course of practicality. Here in Jamaica, Christopher Montgomery, a.k.a. Aaron Holland, could truly be free. Avery stared through the windshield as Walt pulled into the marina's parking lot. The masts of other sailboats poked into the sky, but she recognized Christopher's boat immediately. Avery led the way, with Walt and Christopher following. She walked down the dock and stopped when she came to the stern of the boat. The name was printed in cursive, and Avery was thrilled with how it turned out. Connie had done a spectacular job. Clairvoyance, too. She felt Christopher's arm wrap around her shoulder.
I've told you before, but I just want to make sure you know how grateful I am for everything you've done.
I know.
I'll pay you back somehow.
No, you won't.
Probably not.
But when things calm down, you can show me the Caribbean on this gorgeous boat.
Deal.
You think you'll be okay?
He nodded and continued to stare at the boat.
I'll be fine. Is it hard to get used to a new name?
Depends on why you changed it.
To find freedom.
Then it's easy. You're Aaron Holland from now on. You live on a sailboat and sail the Caribbean. Every few months, you come back to Jamaica to work at a rum distillery. There are worse things than that.
I'm worried about the money. I don't feel right taking it from you.
It's already done. Too late to worry now.
Her contract from Hap News had been finalized earlier in the fall. It named Avery as the host of American events for the next 5 years. Dwight Corey had negotiated tirelessly, and Mosley Germain and David Hillary had signed off on the final details of the contract that would pay Avery $3 million a year for 5 years. Even at that number, Avery argued that she was undervalued. The show's most recent numbers had proven she was correct. The Victoria Ford special, which spanned 3 episodes, had brought the second highest ratings in American events history. That Avery's investigative reporting and the new evidence she unearthed had spurred the reopening of the Cameron Young investigation only added notoriety to her already powerful name. Cameron Young was back in the news, and serious questions were being raised about who had killed him. The evidence that had once so clearly pointed at Victoria Ford was now being questioned. The idea that the blood and the urine had so clearly been manipulated and planted came under immense scrutiny. The Innocence Project had even gotten involved, promising to continue the crusade to prove Victoria Ford's innocence. The American Events special had not named names as to who might have planted the evidence, because to do so was a liability the network was not prepared to take. And it had never been Avery's goal to solve the case. she'd made just two promises. The first was to Emma Kind that Avery would do her best to show the world that Victoria was innocent. The second was to Natalie Ratcliffe that, in exchange for Natalie's help, Avery would stay silent on the truth about Victoria's disappearance. She had made good on both. The Victoria Ford special was topped in the ratings only by Avery's exposé on her father, the thief of Manhattan. The two-part series covered the life of Claire Montgomery, aka Avery Mason, and detailed how Avery had worked with the FBI to track her father down and bring him to justice. During the negotiations on how Avery would deliver her father, she had insisted that the federal agents wear cameras and microphones. The body cam footage from the SWAT team as they crashed through the front door of the isolated, lonely cabin in the mountains of Lake Placid was something not to be missed. And no one did. 22 million viewers tuned in to watch the episode. For Avery, the episode was cathartic on many fronts. In the end, despite her mild protests, Avery knew the contract from Hap News provided everything she had asked for and more. Dwight structured the deal to be front-loaded, and it paid Avery a signing bonus of $3 million. She did two things with the bonus. First, she opened an account at Canevest Bank and Trust on Grand Cayman in the name of Erin Holland, with a starting balance of $100,000. It would be enough for Christopher to start his new life. The second thing Avery did was pay for the sailboat. She sent the cashier's check, certified, overnight, and knew it would arrive later today. Avery looked around the marina.
Better get going, big brother.
There were no surveillance cameras here, and Avery knew no one in the government was interested in her whereabouts any longer. Walt had made sure of that before allowing her to come to Jamaica. Her fame, however, drew the odd paparazzi, and the last thing Avery needed was photos of her and her dead brother showing up in the tabloids. She wasn't too concerned. This port was off the beaten path and far from the touristy areas of the island. Still, even with no one paying attention to the three Americans standing on the dock, Avery knew if they waited much longer, one of them might back out of the plan. They had come too far to get cold feet now. Christopher nodded. He turned to Walt.
Thanks for all your help.
Sure thing. You know where I live if you need anything.
Christopher turned to Avery. She felt him kiss her forehead. He didn't say anything more. There was nothing left to say. Instead, he climbed onto his new vessel.
Stay safe.
10 minutes later, Clairvoyance 2 was motoring out of the marina. Once it was in the open water, Avery saw the mainsail climb the mast and fill with air. The front sail followed, and the boat heeled slightly to the left as it took on an eastern tack and headed into the morning sun.
So, how long are you staying?
I'm off for a week.
Then what?
You tell me.
Walt took her hand as they walked along the dock.
I was thinking I should start spending some more time in the States.
Avery looked at him with slivered eyes.
I thought you hated New York.
I do. I was thinking California was more my style.
Sister Bay, Wisconsin, Friday, October 29th, 2021. Connie Clarkson opened the front door and looked down to see the UPS envelope on the ground. She picked it up and walked back into the kitchen, where she dropped it on the table. She turned the burner off and poured the boiling water into a mug with the strings of two tea bags hanging over the rim. She allowed them to steep for 2 minutes, then pulled the tea bags from the mug and dropped them in the garbage. She brought her mug to the kitchen table and sat down. She tore the thread from the top of the UPS envelope. Pushing the edges together, she saw that there was a single piece of paper inside, along with a business-sized white envelope. She turned the package over and the contents slid onto the table. Lifting the paper, she unfolded it. It held a short, handwritten message. Dear Connie, you've done more than anyone else would have done, more than either of us expected. We owe you everything and can never repay you. But we can at least give you what was taken. Love, Claire and Christopher. The boat, Connie assumed, had made it safely to Jamaica. She put the paper down and reached for the envelope. She stuck her finger under the edge and ripped it open. Inside was a cashier's check. After she pulled it from the envelope, she looked long and hard at the number printed on it. She had trouble comprehending that it was real. It was made out for $2 million, the exact amount she had handed over to Garth Montgomery years ago. Santorini, Greece, Wednesday, December 15th, 2021. For the first time in nearly 20 years, Natalie Ratcliffe was late delivering a manuscript. Her impeccable track record of punctuality had been broken this time, and for good reason. So much had happened since summer to thwart her creativity and productivity. But now, finally, she was attempting to put the finishing touches on her latest Peg Perigo story. And just in the nick of time, the world was waiting. The book was slated for publication the following spring. Over the years, Natalie Ratcliffe and Victoria Ford had developed a routine. Victoria wrote the first draft of each manuscript and sent it off to Natalie, who reworked the story, picking out the flaws and inconsistencies. This many years later, they both knew Peg Perigo equally well, but they each knew her differently. The advantage Victoria held from having originally created the affable character more than 25 years earlier was matched by Natalie's understanding of how to mold Peg Perigo's character for maximum commercial appeal. Together, they had developed a smooth back and forth that, while never fully escaping disagreement, always avoided argument. Until this year. Until the 16th Peg Perigo novel. This time, there were deep disparities on how they each thought the plot should be structured. Emailing their opinions and attempting to work through the problems from thousands of miles away had only added fuel to the fire, so Natalie arranged a trip to Santorini to sort out the details. Victoria and Natalie sat in the splendid Ratcliffe-owned villa on the tiny island of Santorini. They had spent the week reading and rereading the manuscript, tweaking and reworking the story in an attempt to find common ground on which they could both agree. Natalie had fought hard to convince Victoria that they should stick with the formula that had produced 15 bestsellers and had sold 100 million copies. Victoria, on the other hand, wanted to go in a different direction. A darker, edgier direction that had been absent from all the previous Peg Perigo stories. Natalie had noticed this change to Victoria's writing since summer. An edge to Victoria's writing that didn't match the voice from the previous decade and a half of work. They wrote hard-boiled mysteries, not dark thrillers, and they had been spectacularly successful at it. Their readers expected a certain genre, and using their beloved protagonist in such a dark way would not be well received. But no matter how many times Natalie pointed this out, Victoria refused to listen. She simply came back with darker ideas still. Natalie was sitting on the veranda of the villa and reading the latest version of the manuscript Victoria had produced. Victoria walked out and popped the cork to a bottle of Dom Perignon. The Aegean Sea was in front of them, and the air was chilly. It seemed to Natalie to fill Victoria with vigor. More than that, actually. Natalie sensed defiance in the way Victoria carried the bottle of champagne and filled their glasses.
Well, what do you think? Is it our best yet?
Natalie felt a strange shiver climb up her spine. There was something in the way Victoria asked the question that made Natalie hesitant to voice her true opinion. Still, she tried one last time.
Vic, this is not what our readers want from us. It's not what they want from Peg Perigo.
Victoria handed Natalie a champagne flute filled to the brim.
Ah, why do you say that? It's okay if Peg gets an investigation wrong. It'll build her character in future books.
Sure, it's just that the way it happens, I'm not sure we should go in that direction.
Of course we should. It's the only way Peg Perigo could be fooled. It goes hand in hand with the title I've come up with.
Victoria reached over and touched her glass to Natalie's.
Besides, it's too late to change things now. I've already sent the manuscript to New York.
Another chill ran through Natalie's body when Victoria smiled at her. It felt like Victoria was daring her to protest. Something told her not to, so she didn't. Instead, Natalie lifted the champagne and smiled back at her friend. Santa Monica, California, Saturday, April 16th, 2022. Walt had not made the formal move from Jamaica to California, but it was inevitable. He visited more and more often, to the point that Avery had given him a key to her place. She was getting used to the Friday afternoons that she came home from the studio to find a rental car in the driveway and Walt making dinner in her kitchen, a glass of wine waiting for her. After spending most of his life on the East Coast, Walt pledged never to spend another winter anywhere the temperature dipped below 50 degrees. He rather enjoyed, he told her over the last year, bouncing between the Caribbean and Southern California. He was staying for a week this visit, and they were taking advantage of rare downtime Avery had before she would be busy recording the last few episodes of her second full season as host of American Events. After this weekend, they wouldn't see each other again until Avery headed to Jamaica in July to spend a month during her summer break from AE. She hadn't seen Christopher since the previous October and was anxious to hear about his adventures at sea. Walt had provided updates over the months, reporting back to Avery every time Christopher returned to Jamaica to restock supplies. Clairvoyance, too, was proving to be as formidable a vessel as Avery had predicted, and Christopher was enjoying his new life as Aaron Holland. Avery and Walt returned home from a late dinner. Walt turned on the Yankees game. They were playing the A's, and they had made it home for the ninth inning. Avery poured them each a glass of wine, and while Walt became engrossed in the game, she returned to the book she was reading, the latest Peg Perigo novel, which was proving to be as unputdownable as all the others she had read over the last few months. This one, though, had her on edge in a way the other books in the series hadn't. It was darker than the previous ones and more intense. She was lost in the pages. The Yankees game ended. Walt clicked off the television.
I'm heading to bed.
I'll be up in a little while. I just have another couple of chapters.
Walt kissed her and disappeared up the stairs. Avery reached for her glass of wine before returning to the pages. As her eyes skimmed through the final chapters, time seemed to stop and the pages flew past with no effort at all. The ending materialized and Avery anticipated the twist as she read. It would be the first time in Peg Perigo's storied career that she got a homicide investigation wrong. It would be the first time the lovable character got duped. The way it happened brought goosebumps to Avery's skin. It was clever and cunning, and the only way for the endearing heroine to be fooled. Not even Peg Perigo would suspect that the killer planted her own blood at the crime scene to lead detectives in the wrong direction. Avery's mind spun as she read the final page. Finally, she closed the book and looked up at the blank television where the Yankees game had been playing a few minutes earlier. Then, she turned the book over and looked at the cover. The wine glass dropped from her hand and shattered on the floor when she reread the title with a new understanding of what it all meant. The Perfect Murder, a Peg Perigo novel. The night of Cameron Young's death, July 14th, 2001. Victoria Ford walked back into the bedroom wearing nothing but a silk robe that was unclasped and open in the front, covering her breasts, but revealing her cleavage, her smooth midsection, and the fact that she was wearing nothing else. She kept her right hand hidden behind her back. Cameron was lying on the bed with his hands tied to each bedpost. She had made sure to secure the knots tighter than normal. He was still breathing heavily from what she had done to him. The normal lightheartedness of their role-playing was gone tonight, and Victoria saw the deep purple welts wrapping around his thigh and shoulders as he lay on his back. She had been particularly violent with the whip, but he hadn't protested. She needed his body to look very different from the home video she had secretly taken of both of them. She walked over to the bed and climbed on top of him, straddling his waist. The silk robe slid off her shoulders and crumpled into a pile behind her. She leaned over and put her lips to his ear.
I want to make sure you know how I feel about you tonight.
As she kissed his ear, she slowly dragged the length of rope she had hidden behind her back along the side of his face and over his head until it was around his neck. She immediately felt his arousal and knew this would be easier than she imagined. She pulled the rope upward, and the slip knot tightened down on his skin. His hips rose up into her. Victoria laid the end of the rope on the bed. It curled over the pillows like a serpent's tail. Then she kissed him again, this time on the mouth. It was a deep, forceful kiss, almost violent. She could feel that it sent him into a state of euphoria. Then she kissed his chin and his neck and his throat and his chest. She continued her descent along his sternum and down to his navel, where she paused for a moment to look up at him. He was panting like a dog, waiting, wanting, so vulnerable and distracted that he would never have a chance. She finished her descent. She wanted to bring him to the edge of ecstasy, but no further. Victoria wanted him to die at the same proverbial place where he had killed her, on the cusp of bliss and joy, and completely blindsided. When she felt that he was close to climax, she stopped and quickly jumped off him. Two quick steps put her at the head of the bed, where she grabbed the rope before Cameron's eyes were open. She wrapped the rope in her hands and pulled with all her strength. With his hands bound to the bedposts, Cameron was helpless. It went on for close to a minute before the rope binding his right wrist broke free and he clawed at his throat, trying but failing to loosen the rope that Victoria was strangling him with. It took another full minute before his body relaxed. Another minute more until she was sure he was dead. When she finally released her grip and looked at Cameron's lifeless body, his face was purple and his lips were black. His penis was engorged but deflated and fell pathetically across his hip. It was the perfect way for him to die. Victoria quickly got to work. From her bag, she removed the items she needed. Her urine was in a sealed Tupperware container. Her research told her that by now the enzymes would have broken down into ammonia, tipping off investigators that there was no earthly way possible the urine could have come from her body in the last 24 hours. It would be the first clue to investigators that the scene had been staged. The tampon was in a plastic Ziploc. Ever since the abortion, Victoria had bled frequently and heavily. The idea of planting her blood tonight in an effort to lead investigators to Tessa Young had been conjured as the remnants of Victoria's unborn child poured from her body. Tessa carried the child Cameron was meant to give Victoria, and they both should be punished. This blood, Victoria knew, was contaminated with the toxic chemicals found in cotton tampons. It would be another clue to investigators. The next item she removed was the wine glass that was coated with her lipstick and fingerprints. Victoria had stashed it away over the 4th of July weekend, at the end of the night, after Tessa had placed all their glasses into the dishwasher. The fact that this glass also held Tessa's fingerprints would further lead investigators to her. The culinary knife Victoria had used over the 4th to chop vegetables also held both hers and Tessa's prints. The last item in the bag was the thumb drive that held the homemade sex tape. Victoria had planned the video carefully to make it look like neither she nor Cameron knew they were being recorded. It turned out even better than she imagined. She planted the thumb drive in the desk drawer of Tessa's office. By themselves, each item may not be enough, but all together and added to the bowline knots Victoria had spent hours learning to tie, they would paint a clear picture of a jilted wife attempting to frame her husband's lover for his murder. Victoria was certain of it. She believed she had calculated everything perfectly. But Victoria never planned on a district attorney refusing to follow the evidence, or a sycophant detective refusing to trust his instincts. When Victoria was finished staging the scene, there was only one thing left to do. She turned her attention to Cameron. Moving his lifeless body was like lifting a heavy garbage bag filled with waste. But she managed, and eventually, she hoisted Cameron Young over the balcony and dropped him into the night. Twenty Years Later by Charlie Donley is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2022 by Charlie Donley. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2025 Graphic Audio LLC. All rights reserved. Narrated by Eva Wilhelm. Featuring Elena Anderson as Avery and Torian Brackett as Walt. With additional performances by Holly Adams, Ian Putnam, Scott McCormick, Richard Rowan, Crystal Lee, Lise Bruno, Sura Sue, Yasmin Twazan, Dawn Ursula, Christopher Walker, Nora Ashradi, Taylor Coan, Danny Gavigan, Elias Khalil, Terence Aselford, Gabriel Michael, Nanette Savard, Mike Carnes, Stephen Carpenter, Colleen Delaney, Joey Sorlis, Todd Schofield, Bradley Foster Smith, Wynn Delano, Elliot Dash, Jessica Threet, and Ken Jackson. Directed and adapted for graphic audio by Nathaniel Perry. Produced by Colleen Delaney, Scott McCormick, David Zitney, Casey Green, and Aaron Coe. Executive producers, Angie Cornette, Dwayne Beeman, and Matt Webb. Dialogue editing by Nathaniel Perry. Graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry. If you enjoyed 20 Years Later, you might also enjoy Those Empty Eyes by Charlie Donley. All these titles and many more are now available at www.graphicaudio.net.
Why would you visit Diggins Point?
I have my reasons. My kind are mysterious like that.
Your kind?
Here. Let me show you. Might want to shade your eyes.
A moment later, light poured into the chamber, spilling from a small hole in the hull. Tress blinked, pushing her frazzled hair out of her eyes as she made out her surroundings. She was in a cell built into part of the ship's hold, maybe 4 feet on each side and not much taller. Across from her, lashed on top of some boxes, was a much smaller cage. In it sat a common black rat. He'd pulled a cork from the hole with his little paws.
I keep this thing plugged so they don't know about it. Don't want them to move the cage, you know.
The rat turned and saw her for the first time, then cocked his head.
What?
The rat was silent. Tress pulled back. She didn't like the way the rat stared at her with those beady little eyes.
What?
Didn't get a good look at you when they brought you down. I didn't realize... Didn't expect you to be so young. You're no royal inspector.
I have a young face.
I'm sure.
The rat moved to the edge of his cage and sat on his haunches, leaning forward, tiny paws together. It was a very rat-like pose, which Tress supposed made sense.
You're sneaking off the island. Why under the moons would you do that?
I told you, nobody wants to be on Diggins Point. Anyway, the sailors bought my act, so you don't need to keep staring at me like that. My escape plan worked.
Save for the whole accidentally frightening a bunch of smugglers part, I assume.
Tress wiped her eyes once more.
Can we maybe backtrack on this conversation? It looks like we missed the main roadway. I don't mean to be rude, but you are a rat.
Seems self-evident.
But you're talking.
Again, self-evident.
Yes, but how?
With my mouth. Also reference my previous answer.
She bit her lip. It was a testament to her state of mind that she'd pushed him that far already. Was asking a talking rat why he could talk impolite? She probably would have been offended if someone had asked her why she could talk. The rat moved to pick up the cork.
There's a story behind how I can talk, I suppose. It's not one I'm interested in telling.
Huh.
What?
It's just, I'm not used to people saying things like that.
The rat nibbled a bit on the cork, then moved it toward the hole.
Could you leave the hole open a little longer?
The rat nearly had the cork positioned, but he lowered it to the cage floor again.
So, smugglers.
Thanks for listening to this Graphic Audio production. Graphic Audio has over 1,700 titles to choose from. Listen to over 225 binge-worthy series. We feature titles in genres like science fiction, fantasy, romantasy, westerns, mystery thrillers, comics, and more. Check out our exclusive series such as Deathlands, Rogue Angel, Outlanders, Tangent Knights, and Agent of Exiles, which are only available in our dramatized adaptation format. Experience a radically different type of audiobook produced with a full cast, sound effects, and cinematic music. Listen to a movie in your mind, on the go, anytime, anywhere. Our dramatized adaptation titles are available at all major audiobook retailers and platforms. Sign up for our email newsletter for the latest updates and new releases. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and other social platforms. For more information and samples of all our titles, visit our website at graphicaudio.net.